The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Please welcome to the stage author and host of NPR's All Things Considered, Ari Shapiro, and restaurateur Mike Solomonov.
Philadelphia has my two tied favorite people, Terry Gross and this man right here.
Well, we're lucky to have you. Thank you so much for being here. How are you all doing? Good? Great.
Oh. So nice to see people I'm talking to for a change.
I know. I hear the voice. I guess that's it. Why are you... Let's just get right down to it.
Yeah, you all look nothing like what I imagined either. So let's just get that out of the way.
Yeah, enough about them. But listen, we're going to do some questions, and then we'll do a little Q&A at the end. But I'm used to being interrupted, so also if you just want to shout out.
I'm sorry, I have something to say.
No. Yeah, there you go. There it is. But okay, so that's it. About the voice.
The instrument. I like to call it the instrument.
It's right. Multi-talented, and we'll get to that as well. But you do so much storytelling. Why did you decide to make your life a little more complicated and actually write a book?
I never thought I would. I had so many conversations with people over the years who asked if I would write a book, and I always said no, up until the minute that I realized I had started writing one. And it was 2020, it was September, I had not taken any vacation time all year. By the way, random side note, the last restaurant meal I had before the pandemic was at Zahav on March 20th, 2020. But by September of 2020, I hadn't taken any vacation time, so for the first time in my life, I took 4 weeks in a row off from NPR, and I went to this cabin in this redwood forest in Northern California. It was a place called Salmon Creek Farm. Amazing place. And for the first 2 weeks, I just chopped wood and pickled zucchini and harvested apples. And then I started writing what I thought was going to be a solo cabaret show, which I still will someday do. I've done them before, and I will do them again. And as I was writing, I was like, wait, no, this actually feels more like an essay that might belong in a book. And so I thought, well, I'll just keep going and see what it turns into. And what it turned into was this. So I guess I wrote a book.
You did write a book. It's incredible. And actually, I got a copy of this last week, and I've been reading it all week, and it is incredible. And I was telling you that there's so much that I can sort of identify with, but there's little bits that I just love. And we talked about our love for the Oregon coast, or my love for it. And this image of you sort of wading around in tide pools.
Yeah.
Right? On this coast that isn't a beach at all. It's freezing cold. It's sort of like Jurassic Park-y and wild, foraging for mushrooms. And that curiosity and energy is, maybe this isn't a question, maybe this is just a statement. I feel like that is what has sort of set the course for your life.
You totally put your finger on it. Like, my parents taught me that the more you learn about the world, the more interesting life is. And so we would go tide pooling, we would go bird watching, we would go wild mushroom hunting. And it's like, you know, I'm looking over your shoulder at this stand that is so beautifully carved, and I want to know, who made that? What is the wood that it's made out of? What is the, artistic movement that this is a part of? How does this fit into culture and history? And I feel like, yeah, that's a beautiful piece of wood, a beautiful stand that I can appreciate. But if I know something contextually about it, if I know what the bird is that I'm looking at and whether it's migrating or whether it lives there permanently, if I know, and this is true not just of nature, not just of art, but of politics, of history, of science, of business. And so that curiosity that I cultivated as a kid on the Oregon coast staring at tide pools for many, many minutes is something that I now get to apply to literally everything because, as the title of my show implies, we consider all things.
Have you considered that this is Philadelphia and we can literally steal that podium right after the show?
You and me. under our arm. Just
we call that foraging here on the East Coast.
East Coast foraging. I wonder. I have to take a flight tomorrow. I wonder if it'll fit in the overhead bin.
It might.
No, but it's exactly like that's it. And so now I do a show where I know, like every day, I wake up knowing that by the time I go to sleep, I'm going to have learned about something that I didn't understand when I woke up that morning. And that keeps me excited about like doing the show day after day, year after year for more than 7 years now.
I love that. I want your parents to write a book about raising incredibly intelligent children that have perfect genes.
Can I just tell you, I have amazing parents. And also, when I was talking to my mother who lives in Portland about my Portland book event. And she said, do I get to offer a rebuttal?
Oh.
And then she said someone called her for an interview and said, you know, most memoirs are about what miserable childhoods people had. And it seems like Ari had a really good childhood. So I said, okay, Mom, so is the rebuttal like actually his childhood was miserable?
Right.
Contrary to like, yeah, I had great parents. I love my parents.
Your parents,
they're wonderful.
I love your parents and I don't know them, but they sound fantastic. And I love your childhood and I even the first chapter, I was just so inspired and really I admired you as a kid. I admired the confidence that you had and your sort of intention of just being who you were. And I find that to be so rare now. And I wonder what it would be like if we grew up with like social media handles, you know?
I mean, it's, you know, boy, it's, so I think about like if TikTok had existed when I was a kid, if I was, you know, as a teenager, on the one hand, being exposed to people who I would identify with as being like, oh, I'm not the only one. And on the other hand, having to be on public display from the time you're, you know, creating an account in front of any number of, you know, judgy eyes, I don't think I would have liked it. But I mean, what you're alluding to is that in Fargo, North Dakota, where I lived till I was 8, I was the only gay kid. My brother and I were the only Jewish kids. Have you ever seen that clip of the newscast where they're like, this man climbed to the top of Mount Everest and he's gay? I mean, blind. Yeah. He's blind.
Yeah.
Have you seen that clip? Anyway, I was the only Jewish kid at my school in Fargo. Yeah. And so we'd like go from classroom to classroom with a menorah and a dreidel explaining, really, no, I'm serious. Like, and I would explain what Hanukkah is in Fargo, and then we moved to Portland when I was 8, and when I was 16, I came out of the closet, and I was the only, here I mean to say, gay kid at my high school. And so again, I was sort of like being a translator, an ambassador, telling people about something that might have seemed foreign or unfamiliar to them. And then the like leap I made when I became a journalist was the realization that I can do that same thing and perform these acts of like ambassadorial translation with groups that I have no personal connection to beyond my curiosity. So I can go to a Bikers for Trump rally or to, you know, a town where Syrian refugees are fleeing ISIS and do that same kind of like, here's something that might seem foreign or different or strange and help people understand and relate to it.
You don't bring a menorah to the Bikers for Trump rally, though,
nope.
Right?
No.
Right.
No.
Not a
no.
huge market for that.
Yeah, not exactly.
So what, I mean, tell me about a stranger that didn't make the cut for the book.
Oh my God. I did an interview yesterday where somebody asked me about a story they had found that I literally had no memory of. And after the interview, I went and looked it up and I was like, oh, I should have put that in the book. Truly, like, okay, so it was when the Martin Luther King Memorial opened in Washington, D.C., and I went, and there was this old man there whose great grandmother had been enslaved, and he was talking about the sort of, you know, generational evolution, and he was sort of in awe of, and I actually, literally, I sent this screen grab of the transcript to my husband, and I was like, fuck, I should have included this in the book. So the guy says, I'm gonna find this. This is, okay. I'm like talking to him and I say, I gotta tell you, hearing your story and seeing this through the eyes of your great grandmother, it's really moving. And he replies, you live long enough, son, you're gonna have some stories too, I assure you.
Oh God.
Why didn't I put that in the book? I didn't even remember it. Then he says, that's the way this thing is, you understand? We have stories. If we make it through the day, you understand, and rejoice in the morning, we'll make it, you know, peace in that day. it's not hard. Life's not hard. It's just a little troublesome sometimes, you know? Just make it through the day. That's all.
Oh, my God. Can you send me that text every single morning?
I mean, seriously. I told Mike, like, ugh, well, I missed that chance. And he said, we're just going to have to write a book called The Next Best Strangers in the World.
That's good. But that rejoice that you have, that optimism, you carry with you. And I think it's important, especially as it relates to the Instagram-y swiping for horrible news all the time. I mean, you can't escape it, right?
Totally. And the truth is, one reason that I wanted to write this book is that friends have, over the years, often asked how I stay optimistic in the face of all of the terrible things that happen in the world that I cover as a journalist. You know, I talk to people on the worst day of their lives often, whether it's a mass shooting or a natural disaster or a war. And I am optimistic, and I do have faith in humanity. And the people in this book are kind of the reasons why. You know, as I go through life and I see these difficult, terrible scenarios, I also see people who are trying to help, who are working to make life better, who are trying to find solutions and improve the lives of the world, of the people around them. And I feel like when I see that, I'm like, well, if those people have hope and optimism and are making the effort, what right do I have to feel despair? Like, I sit in this position of extraordinary privilege and power. If I start giving in to despair and pessimism, then I'm doing a disservice to these people who are working so hard every day.
Yeah. And what has been the closest you've got, if you can recall a time where you were like, this is too much, or I can't really escape this feeling of disparity, or maybe I'm too scared to cover this assignment?
What's strange is that there's a kind of defense mechanism that sets in when I'm in the reporting mode. And so I have often had the experience of being in a situation that is super intense and just being laser focused on what I have to do and putting the story together, sending all the elements to, you know, this is often like I'll be in a war zone, or like I'm thinking about when I was in Colombia doing a story about Venezuelan refugees, and there were people who were walking 250 miles from the border of Venezuela and Colombia to Bogota. And so my team and I basically followed this 250-mile route, talking to people all along the way, and put together this sort of audio documentary with all these stories. And it was when we were like in Bogota, the last day before we flew home, and the story aired on the radio, and I listened to it, streaming it online. And I remember then, as I was listening to the finished story, I allowed myself to feel all of, I mean, not allowed myself, like I was overcome by all the emotions that I think otherwise one would have felt when having those real-time conversations. But because I was focused on doing the job, the sort of defense mechanism set in. And so often I feel like it's only when I'm out of it and I'm thinking back on it and I'm listening to the stories later that I allow myself to really fully experience it. And also, you know, you do practice self-care. Like, so your friend and mine, Benj Pasek, played the role of Michael Solomonoff last night in New York in my first book event. And I talk in the book about the Pulse nightclub shooting, which I went to cover. Shortly after the Pulse nightclub shooting, a good friend and colleague was killed in Afghanistan, and I happened to be in Portland where his parents lived, and I visited his parents. And after those two things back-to-back, I just thought, like, I need to take some time off. Who's the friend I have who has the most flexible schedule? Benj Pasek. So yes. I called Benj, and he and I went to Provincetown, and we just like spent a few days on Cape Cod in this little like two-bedroom bungalow decompressing. And I think recognizing that you need something like that and taking the time to do something like that is what allows you to go back out and do the work again.
Benj Pasek also is the key. You all need to know Benj Pasek. He'll sort of draw the best out of you. But I
Is his mother here tonight, by the way? You raised a mensch. You raised a mensch.
It's true. Yeah. True story. I feel like we should just talk about Benj for the rest of the night. But
what's your favorite Benj Pasek song? No, I'm just.
I know. Well, actually, I think about this a lot too. I mean, now you know, I have kids, right? So everything sort of changes, and I have to explain really difficult things to them or figure out how to do this. Yeah. And we have rituals that really help us out. And I would say I'm quite spiritual.
Can you tell us about one of them?
Well, yeah, I mean, I grew up conservative Jewish, but mostly just because there was more Hebrew in the conservative
shul,
right? Yeah. And so I didn't grow up with a ton of prayer, but we say the Shema every night. And I actually wrap tefillin in the morning. Again, I'm not religious, but it's just what I do. And with the kids, we actually, the greatest showman, there's from now on, there's like a song that my kids love. And now my sons are 8 and 11, and I have like a 3-week-old daughter. And so my sons...
And he's still here tonight. I mean...
I know. I mean, it's, you know, it's the most sane environment we have right now. So, but my kids really love music. And they're really interested in everything. So I just, you know, music and really like not listening to the news and really staying away from podcasts, I'm sorry, but in the morning has been really helpful for us. So we do those things. Like we say the Shema, we talk about, you know, loved ones that are no longer with us regularly. And
it's so funny to hear you talk about not being particularly religious, but putting on tefillin, because my dad has always been a very active member of the Jewish community. Like, he's in the Chevra Kedisha, he leads services at the Jewish retirement home, we kept kosher in Fargo. I mean, like, and at some point, when I was well into adulthood,
Kosher in Fargo sounds like a good book title.
Our meat was delivered once a month on a freezer truck from Chicago, truly. And my mother would like make challah every Friday night in Fargo. So anyway, at some point, this is not in the book. I was in adulthood, and I was talking to my dad about something Judaism related, and he sort of offhandedly said, "Well, I don't believe in God, like obviously." And I was like, "I'm sorry, what?" Like, you are the person who every decision you've made in life has been motivated by your Jewish identity and values and community. And fine, you don't believe in God, but the way you say it is like, well, obviously, I don't believe in God. I was like, what?
Yeah, you got to wait a little bit later in life for you to hear that.
Yeah.
Well, so those things are important. And I feel like in terms of passing down tradition, but also making these memories, like painting these memories that we'll all have together as a family is very, very important. Mm-hmm. So I want to switch gears really quickly to Pink Martini.
Oh, yeah.
What is it that you do that you're not great at? Because you're an amazing musician.
There's a lot of things I'm not
good at. You're a good cook.
You have an amazing voice. Thank you. I cannot throw a football. I'm really bad at baking because I can't really follow directions to the letter. And when I tried to do the pandemic baking thing, it didn't really... The one thing that I succeeded at baking that I... So I don't know if you know Ruthie Rogers, the River Cafe.
I do.
When I lived in London, I spent a lot of time with her. And so I made her polenta almond lemon cake. And that was a really good... That was like my one bake. I realized you asked what I'm not good at. And I'm like, I made this delicious cake.
See? He started by saying, I'm not a good baker, and voila.
I found one thing that I can bake. I found one thing that is the exception to the rule. So Pink Martini, this local band from Portland, Oregon, that I was a fan of when I was in high school. It's like a little orchestra of more than a dozen people, and the lead singer is a woman, and I make guest appearance. China Forbes. I'm talking as though nobody's ever heard. Yes. Oh, I know you're not China, but somebody's waving as if to say that's me, China Forbes, but no. A friend, a relative, a cousin. Every city we go to, China has cousins. Literally, it's like, oh, my cousins are coming backstage after the show. More cousins? China, how many cousins do you have? Anyway, I've been like making guest appearances with them as a singer for 13 years now.
Unbelievable.
It is crazy. It is surreal. The fact that the band even exists still like 30 years after it was founded.
But also that kind of band, too. Yeah. I mean, it's just different. Do you guys all know Pink Martini? My top three favorite songs in the world, Hey Eugene.
Yeah.
It's so
good.
Can I
tell you, singing backup on Hey Eugene is more fun than singing lead vocals on literally anything.
It's so good. So, so good. And actually, I have a request for you. Can you all do a cover of the song by Mac Miller and Anderson .Paak called Dang?
I don't know the song, but sure.
But yes.
Yes.
You heard it, right? Okay, it's gonna be amazing.
Can't wait.
You
said your three favorite songs. Hey Eugene, what are the other two?
My other two.
I mean, I don't mean to put you on the spot.
Right now, what is it? There's Jimi Hendrix, Axis Bold is Love. That's one of my, that's like number
two.
Oh,
I thought you meant your three favorite Pink Martini songs.
No. Eugene is one of my favorite songs of all time.
Of your three favorite songs of all time, one is a Pink Martini song. That is high praise.
Yes.
That is truly high praise.
Yes. And you're in the band. So you...
And the last time the band came here, we went to your restaurants and brought food for all of them because we were like... You're not going to have time to go, but you need to eat this food because it's the best in the world. And they were so... We were at Symphony Hall at the Kimmel Center and, like, got, merkaz, bowls of hummus and salatim and pita. And
it's a good thing I didn't bring it. I would have totally lost it and freaked out. Or I would have forced myself on stage.
I invited you. You had another commitment that night.
I did. I know.
The next time we're here, you're coming on stage with us. You're going to sing Back Up on Hey Eugene with me.
I'm going to ruin that song.
We'll turn off your mic. It'll be fine.
Yeah, but so listen, you go from like following a Syrian refugee starting in Bodrum through years, basically, right? Mm-hmm. And you go through like the most intense sort of scenes and relationships in the world. And then you also get up on stage at the Hollywood Bowl and just turn it on and become a rock star. How do you do that?
Well, they're a little more similar than you might initially think. They're more similar than I initially thought. I always thought that, like, Pink Martini was the affair I was having on the side, and, like, NPR was my marriage. Although, really, how secret can an affair be when it plays out in front of thousands of people on stage? But I realize now that both of these are ways of connecting with an audience. They're ways of telling stories. They're both about helping people see the world in a slightly different way and relating to one another, in a way that sort of lessens our differences and narrows the divide between people. You know, Pink Martini, as many of you know, sings in dozens of languages. And we don't discriminate based on where we are. So, like, if we're in Turkey, we will still sing songs in Greek, even though the Turks and the Greeks have a little bit of... And if we're in rural red parts of Texas, we'll still do songs in like Farsi and Arabic. And people get up and dance and clap and they do a conga line. And it sort of brings people together, which is not all that different from what I try to do in my stories on NPR.
But the mode is different.
Yeah, totally.
Right. And how do you go from one to the other?
It's actually helpful because when I spend a couple weeks on tour with Pink Martini... or even just like go join them for a long weekend, I feel more rejuvenated going back into the news. There's something so exhilarating about being with this band that, first of all, I've loved since I was a teenager. Second of all, every live show is like a party. Literally, people are dancing in the aisles at the end when we sing Brazil.
It's like a circus.
It's like a circus. Yeah. And so for me, it's just an opportunity to like shake off whatever's going on in the news, have fun, make music with people I love, belt my lungs out, and then go back to like straight-laced, tie-wearing journalist. And each one feeds the other in a way that like I think it's a cure for burnout and being able to use these different skills. It's like cross-training. You know, you're not just doing one thing over and over and over again. You're mixing it up and keeping yourself kind of on your toes.
So if you weren't on NPR, if you weren't in the marriage of NPR, and you weren't with the affair,
I had a hall pass. Is that what you're saying? If NPR gave me a hall pass,
so no NPR and no Pink Martini. What would be it? Yes, no. It would be. Right, it would be a cabaret with Alan Cumming.
Yeah.
Yes.
I always thought so. Like I did make a cabaret with Alan Cumming, but I always thought, which we also did at the Kimmel Cultural Campus, actually. No, but I always thought that like if I weren't at NPR. I wouldn't want to be an Anderson Cooper type. I think, like, I love what I do on All Things Considered, but if I imagine, like, in the multiverse doing something adjacent that's not identical, it would be, somebody told me the term a portfolio career, which is a term that I like, where you have sort of lots of different projects with lots of different people, short, medium, and long term. And actually, one person who I think does that so well is Alan Cumming, who is such a role model to me. And like, you know, he and I make this cabaret together. He just created a solo dance show about the poet Robert Burns. He's right now filming an independent movie in Toronto. Of course, he starred in The Traitors, this, you know, hosting a reality TV show in a castle in the Scottish Highlands. He's about to come out with season two of Schmigadoon, which is called Schmacago. Like, he does all of these completely different kinds of things. He and I are actually doing our show for 2 weeks at the Cafe Carlyle in New York.
Amazing.
And so, you know, he's like directing and acting and doing stage projects and film. And of course, they're all under the umbrella of acting, just as I think everything I do is sort of under the umbrella of storytelling. But there are lots of different ways to tell stories. And so I think the great thing about my life at NPR is it allows me to interview a senator and also spend weeks traveling through Senegal, Morocco, and Spain doing a big project connecting climate change to global migration to political extremism. But if I weren't to be at NPR, I would imagine doing sort of like a smorgasbord of lots of different things.
Right. And what do you have coming up? What are the next, any stories, anything coming up?
So I am, for the first time in my life, taking a 2-month sabbatical from work.
Wow.
Yeah. Unpaid.
To be clear,
I am going exactly where you see me. Monday was the beginning of my sabbatical, and I was recording interviews with Terry Gross, among others. And now I'm doing this 11-city book tour. And then the last city on my book tour is Los Angeles, April 4th. Alan and I open our show at the Carlyle in New York on April 5th. So I'm going from my LA event to a red eye to open at the Carlyle.
Sounds really relaxing.
Yeah, this is my sabbatical. But Michael, my question for you is, as somebody who's gone on book tour, what advice do you have for somebody who's just starting his very first one?
Oh, God, our first book tour sucked.
Well, I'm not cooking for anyone.
No, I went, you know, with my business partner and my best friend, Steve, and that was incredible. What we did not do was self-care. We did not rest, and I think we did so much eating. It's really, really challenging. As you know, when you're traveling around, you're sleeping in hotels, it's very difficult to eat properly.
Yeah.
And that sort of screws you up, especially when you're talking to hundreds of people every single night. So
I am shocked at how few hotels can provide a yoga mat in the hotel room. Because for me, one of the things I picked up actually when I was covering the Romney campaign in 2012, that was when I first started to subscribe to a monthly fee yoga website that has like hundreds of courses that you can sort by time, duration, intensity, body part. And wherever you are, you can like lay down a yoga mat and just do it. So that was kind of my sanity keeping technique when I was on the road with Romney. But I've gotten very good at doing yoga on a bath towel.
Yes, yoga on a bath towel. Room. Another book title.
That's my self-care.
I feel like also for hotels, you know, you can run steps, and that's like really, really good cardio.
Oof.
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
One
or
could,
not.
I
yeah.
suppose. But as you'll find out when you read the book, I tend to sweat a lot, particularly when I'm running. So, yeah, yoga might be the better choice for me.
It sounds like it.
In the cloistered sanctuary, the solitary hotel room.
You're going to do great on book tour, and we look forward to having you back. And maybe with all your free time, you want to spend a day at Zahav, and you can cook with us a little bit. Yes.
Did you really just invite me to cook at
absolutely.
Zahav?
Absolutely. Yes.
Okay.
100%.
To me, this feels like the moment that Alan Cummings said, hey, we should make a show together.
Yeah.
And truly, because he said it as offhandedly as you just said, come cook at Zahav. And I was like, Alan, don't joke about that, because I will absolutely take you up on it. And I'm saying to you right now, Mike, do not joke about inviting me to cook at Zahav for a day.
You were on the schedule. You were on the schedule already for Zahav, okay?
I am done.
Yes. You'll have
game
a blast.
Game over. Set, point, match, sports. Done.
You guys saw this. You heard this from here. Let's take some questions, yeah? Does that sound good?
Thank you. I'm a big fan of yours from NPR, but I do love you in Pink Martini. So
thank
can you.
You
sing a few songs from Pink Martini? A few lines?
You know, I don't have Thomas Lauderdale here. I often get asked at like public speaking events, like, will you sing a song? And I always say I want to protect the separation of church and state. But sort of, you know, part of the mission of this book is to sort of unify all the different threads of who I am. And so I've decided that if on this book tour, if somebody asks, the answer will be yes. But there's another thing that I really enjoy that I'm not able to do in my job. I mean, as I said, I love my job, but I sometimes feel when I'm hosting All Things Considered, like the English language is an endless mansion full of an infinite number of rooms, and I can go into any of them except for one, and that's the room with the velvet rope, on the other side of which all of the cool kids are hanging out with their four-letter words. And I'm just not allowed to go in there. But now, here in this sanctuary, this free library.
Everyone put their phones away. Nobody can record this.
This is a song that was written by an American composer in 2010 that means a lot to me. And I'm going to try to do it a cappella, and I hope you enjoy it. I see you driving round town with a girl I love, and I'm like, fuck you. I guess the change in my pocket wasn't enough. I'm like, fuck you. And fuck her too. Said if I was richer, I'd still be witcher. Now ain't that some shit? And though there's pain in my chest, I still wish you the best with a fuck you. Maybe someday Pink Martini will record that.
How are we supposed to top that? I have no idea. Any other song requests with profanity, please?
Only one per night. That was it. That's all you get.
Oh.
Nobody wants to follow that, huh? And by the way, that was not planted. That was entirely organic.
I'm wondering if you would take a minute or two and talk about one of your favorite interviews within the last year.
Sure. Boy, there's one that I just did that was so, so moving. Mike, do you know who Raghavan Iyer is?
I do.
Do you want to just give a little background on like...
Go.
So, you know, there are people who have really introduced American home cooks and palates to a particular cuisine. Julia Child for French food, Marcella Hazan for Italian, Michael Solomonov for Israeli. And for many decades, Raghavan Iyer has been one of those people for Indian food. He lives in Minneapolis. He's written many cookbooks and done TV shows. And he has, for the last 5 years, been in treatment for aggressive cancer that most people do not survive for as long as he has. And he knows that he is in the final stages, and he has written a new cookbook called On the Curry Trail, which is about the way curry has influenced cuisines all over the world. And so I did a conversation with him that was a little bit about the cookbook, but more about, excuse me, sort of life and his perspective and looking back on everything. And it's really unusual to get the opportunity to talk to somebody in that stage of life towards the end and ask them to reflect. And he was so eloquent, and the things he said were so beautiful. And I asked him a question that I was a little bit nervous and hesitant to ask, but it wasn't a live interview, so I thought, well, if it doesn't go well, we don't have to include that part. Where I said, look, you've devoted your entire life to food, and you recognize that you're in the last lap. Have you decided what you want served at your funeral? And he had. And he told me all about it. And then he said, oh, now I'm getting hungry. And I said, I think there can be no better tribute to you than people eating well and thinking of you as they do it. And so to have that kind of conversation, to have the ability to have that kind of conversation with people, there's so few places you can do that in media today. So that was something that I felt very lucky to be able to do. Have you met him? Do you know him?
I haven't. I definitely know him. And I feel like I just had a conversation about Minneapolis earlier today. It's a really unique city, like Philadelphia, actually. It's sort of like off the map. It is very immigrant friendly, and you often find like incredible food. But the Curry Road, the Curry Trail is you know, anthropologically, it's so fascinating.
Yeah.
And he's also like an incredibly nice person, which is rare for chefs.
I've had good luck to meet the nice ones.
You have, yes. Yeah, well, they're lucky to meet you as well. But that's fantastic. Is he in hospice right now or no?
He's not in hospice. Oh. but, you know, even as we were doing the interview, he was coughing a lot. And he said it wasn't a cold, it was the tumors. And it was interesting. You know, we spoke to him for about 30 minutes, and we cut it down to, it was 8 minutes on the radio and 12 minutes in the podcast, which you don't listen to, and that's fine.
Sorry. I did read the book, so.
You did read the book. With a three-week-old baby, for goodness sake. But we were deciding whether to leave in any of the coughs or not, and we decided we would leave one in, one coughing episode, just to give a sense of the reality of like where he is right now in his progress.
I don't know a lot of NPR reporters' personalities, but I am pretty sure you're the only one who's...
Mostly assholes. No, I'm sorry.
No. I didn't say that. But you're the only one who's... I know the color of his underwear.
Ah,
I know
yes.
that much. Sorry.
Listen to the Fresh Air interview.
Yeah. What does NPR make of you? Like, I don't mean that at all.
Yeah.
Like, you're not necessarily what someone would put together as a NPR broadcaster person. But maybe I'm just the only one who doesn't know the color of the underwear.
No, it's a totally legitimate question, and it's one that I've never really had to confront until this book tour. Because I always felt like, you know, I do what I want to with my vacation time, and if it ends up, you know, on YouTube because what I'm doing is singing at the Hollywood Bowl, that's neither here nor there. And I don't say like, oh, NPR, I'd like to go tour the Middle East with Pink Martini or perform at the Casablanca Jazz Festival. I just say like, may I take off March 17th through the 21st or whatever. But now there's this book which does talk about the color of my, you know, going to an underwear party on Fire Island, among other things. And I don't know what NPR makes of me. I have a feeling that younger people at NPR are happy to see somebody who can sort of exist outside of the mold of the sort of like politically obsessed, single-minded stereotype of a journalist. But a story that I tell early in the book is that when I covered the Justice Department, people who knew that I had been Nina Totenberg's intern, and she, of course, covers the Supreme Court, they would say, oh, you're covering legal affairs just like your mentor. Do you want to be the next Nina Totenberg? And as I describe in the book, I would always reply, no, I don't want to be the next Nina Totenberg. I want to be the first Ari Shapiro. And I was, you know, I was like 23, and it was kind of a dick answer. And and like, I didn't know what it meant to be like the first Ari Shapiro, but what I meant was I just don't want to follow in the footsteps of somebody because those already exist. And, you know, being authentically, emphatically, enthusiastically yourself is the best thing you can be no matter who you are. And I knew that. And so it does give me some sense of pride and satisfaction to be able to say like, oh yeah, I am a little bit of a unicorn at NPR, but that's who I am, and I'm able to do both and not have to give up one part of myself in order to allow another part of myself to flourish.
Excellent.
Thanks.
Excellent.
Hi.
I have a question about connecting. I think that a lot of what you do is not only you're an incredible writer, but you also know how to ask great questions.
Thanks.
And part of the pandemic and also social media, I think that we've lost a skill that comes with being in front of a person and really getting into their skin and into who they are. So what do you have to say to us about connecting with the person in front of you?
I don't think that we have to learn new skills. I think that we have to be reminded of what we have all carried with us evolutionarily from the time we were born. So I think that there are powerful forces that are trying to persuade us to tribalize and view others as enemies and assert that if, you know, you disagree with me, then you are a bad person and wrong. And I think that actually we have the ability and skills to recognize our shared humanity if we just tune out those influences of social media, corporations, political parties that want us to demonize the other and get back in touch with the empathy and listening and connecting skills that we've already had. So that's not a specific piece of advice, but I will give you one specific advice, which might seem counterintuitive coming from a journalist. For me, reading fiction is one of the best ways I know to see the world through the eyes of someone else. Like, if I read a great novel, a compelling short story, I actually quote an Israeli writer named Edgar Keret. Do you know him?
Yeah.
In this, he's so incredible. And he told me in an interview about how he used to write op-eds, and he doesn't anymore because op-eds don't persuade anybody, but instead he writes short stories. And so, like, the short story that I talk about in here is one where somebody who is so rich and lonely, he has more money than he can spend and no friends, so he buys up all the birthdays. So every morning, someone's mother calls him and wishes him a happy birthday. And it's like this beautiful, sort of absurdist allegory that is not about, you know, income inequality per se, but allows us to access ideas and feelings and emotions and perspectives that we might otherwise hold at arm's length. So for me, reading fiction is one simple tool that I use that I find very powerful.
Being a good storyteller, in my mind, means being a good listener. Can you talk at all about how you cultivate your ability to be a good listener?
A lot of it is just practice. I mean, you know, I think being a good host of All Things Considered is not a skill that anyone is born with. But when you do it for 2 hours a day for several years, you get a lot of practice. And I go back and listen to interviews and often think, what could I have done differently or better? But for me, the most revealing moments in interviews are often ones that I never could have planned for, because they come about as a result of a question like, really? Or tell me more? Or give me an example, which is a question you can only ask if you're actually listening. So if I'm doing an interview and I'm focused on what is my next question and when am I going to ask it, then I'm not going to ask the question about, really? Or why do you feel that way? Or what, you know, tell me more about that. And those are the questions that I think A, show you're really listening, and B, lead to the deeper meaning and truth and, like, the vulnerable stuff.
The part that you were mentioning, that you are positive thinking and that you see humanity, like, you have faith in humanity, one of the things that I really like and enjoying about your stories and in all of it is, like, I listen to whatever the news that you're saying, and it is bad, it is sad, but you're always getting to the point where you saw, well, but, you know, we have people that are helping. We have this. How did you see that, and what would you tell us for us to a tool that we can use on the everyday to, like, see that too? Because,
yeah,
like I'm saying, like, you made it every day, and I can hear it in your news, but it would be nice to apply it. On, you know,
I'm so happy to hear that. That means a lot to me, so I appreciate your saying that. There's a very fundamental Mr. Rogers look for the helpers thing, but I also think all the time about one of the most profoundly moving pieces of theater I've ever seen in my life, which I saw here in Philadelphia at the Kimmel Center, which was Taylor Mack's 24-decade history of popular music. Okay, so Taylor Mack wrote this show that is a 24-hour performance, and only once performed the entire 24 hours uninterrupted noon to noon. Wow. In Brooklyn, but the only time they ever did, and then, you know, they toured it all over the place in 4-hour chunks or 6-hour chunks or 3-hour chunks, but Philadelphia was the only place that they ever did it in a 12-hour chunk followed by another 12-hour chunk. So it was noon to midnight on consecutive Saturdays, and it told the story of the United States starting in 1776 to 2016, and every hour was one decade. I could go on and on and on about this performance piece, so I've said enough. But I talked to Taylor about it, and I said, look, when you tell the story of this country, from slavery to the Trail of Tears to, Japanese internment camps and on and on and on and on, and you see all these terrible things contextualized and connected, like, what lessons do you draw from that? And I think all the time about what Taylor said, which is, these things go in cycles, and I don't know why, but they do. But when you tell these stories, you also find the stories of people who are trying to make life better in whatever time and whatever place you are. And so all you can really hope to do in life is be one of those people in the time and the place that you are living in. Can I just say, it is so, like, it is a really strange experience, because radio is such a one-directional medium, And because my body of work is so incremental over a long period of time, and so many stories come and go and vanish, that like when you ask how NPR perceives me and you say that I have a reputation for optimism, these are sort of puzzle pieces that I'm only now just beginning to put together. And it's so like gratifying and reassuring to hear this and to know that like a couple of the early reviews of the book said something like, it's what you would expect from Ari Shapiro. And I'm like, there's something that people would expect from me? Like, like there's a way I'm perceived. It's a very weird experience, but it's really lovely. So thank you for the role you all are playing in this right now.
Oh my gosh. I was thinking about, as you were sort of talking about the optimist in the room, I was thinking about the person that was making tea in the Syrian refugee, you know, like in Turkey. And I was really moved by that as well.
This is a guy who like put out the Wi-Fi login and password at his cafe so that everybody passing through, he's a Turkish guy with a restaurant, and he wanted all the Syrians to be able to, oh, and he also put out power strips so people could charge their phones.
Right.
And he was like, well, if I were in their shoes, I would want to charge my phone and have Wi-Fi so I could talk to my family back home.
Very simple, right?
Very simple. Small act of empathy and humanity and just putting yourself in their shoes. Yeah.
All right, one more question.
Oh, the last question. No pressure.
Whoa.
Ari, you use your hands when you talk so much, you could be an honorary Philadelphian.
Thank you.
But my question is,
I try not to smack the microphone.
Right, well, my question is, do you talk with your hands on the radio?
Not as much as I am now. A little bit. I'm very conscious of it now. But, you know, like, when I'm on the radio, there's, like, two screens in front of me because Elsa Chang is often hosting with me on the West Coast. There's, like, a little Zoom camera here and a TV screen that has her and our director. So, like, there's not a lot of room for a lot of gesturing. But I will say this. I've been doing a bunch of interviews on Zoom lately for the book. Not conducting interviews, but being interviewed. And it's only as others are interviewing me and I'm talking that I discovered a feature on Zoom, which is that if you go like this and your hand is like this for like 3 to 5 seconds, Zoom actually puts up a raised hand emoji icon. And the first time it happened, I was like, oh my God, is there a ghost in the machine? What just happened? And then I realized, no, it's just that when I talk, I go like this, and Zoom thinks I'm raising my hand to be called on. So I guess there's
the
something
Ari Shapiro
to
feature on Zoom. Oh, one more? Okay, sorry, one more.
Is this on? Yeah. I'm curious, given that you are such an incredible interviewer and because you listen, have you ever considered or would you consider doing one subject and do a series of interviews to really dig deep into it? Like, and you're Ari Shapiro, so you're not going to be, but if you're familiar with Studs Terkel's books.
Oh, of course. Yeah, of course.
I just was wondering if something like that ever, you would ever consider doing.
I have done long-term projects, and I like the mix, but so just to give you one example, when we were just beginning to come out of the pandemic recession, I started a project that I called American Indicators, and I wanted to find 4 or 5 people who represented different parts of the U.S. economy who we could talk to over time as either the recession dragged on or the economy bounced back. I wanted to find individuals who we could both talk to collectively and individually. And so with the help of a really skilled producer and editor, we pre-interviewed so many different people in different walks of life, but we ended up finding a hotel owner in the Northeast, a small family manufacturing business in Georgia, a food bank owner in Nevada, a housing lawyer in St. Louis. And so over the course of a few years, we've been talking to those people. And, you know, we've kind of lost touch with some of them. But then the thing that's been really great is as one story kind of foregrounds, like an eviction moratorium is expiring, we can call the housing lawyer and we have a relationship with him and we've heard from him several times over the years. Or just recently, when supplemental SNAP benefits were running out and food assistance was about to be reduced, we called back this woman in Nevada who I've spoken to now several times since we started talking to her early in the pandemic. And we have the context and we have sort of the body of work. And so I like that I can sprinkle those projects in and among the other things. And then I can also do long-term projects, like I did this month-long trip through Senegal, Morocco, and Spain, connecting the dots from climate change to global migration to political extremism. And so the great thing about All Things Considered, particularly since we have four hosts, is that there can always be this sort of expansion, contraction of the timeline and the scale of the projects. And so it might not be as hefty as a Studs Terkel oral history, but there is room for some of that. And I enjoy that as well. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you all so much.
Yes, Philadelphia.
I have one final request. I'm trying to do this at every stop. I know some of you have copies of the book. If you would indulge me, I would love to take a selfie with the two of us and all of you holding up, if you have it, a copy of the book. Would you do that for me? Okay.
Okay. Hold it up. One, two, three. Okay, wait. Let me do one where it's a little brighter in the back. There we go. One, two, three. Okay. All right. Thank you all so much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author-events.